Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present once again Michael Rupert, a former LAPD narcotics investigator who has crusaded over the years very heroically against the intelligence community's involvement in the narcotics traffic. Mike, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Dave, it's always a pleasure.
Now, you've been publishing for a couple of years now your brilliant From the Wilderness newsletter, and remind me if I forget at the end to give all the particulars on that. And in your October 31st, 1999 issue, appropriately enough on Halloween, because this is a spook story, of no small magnitude, you have a blockbuster article entitled, appropriately enough, Why Does George W. Bush Fly in Drug Smuggler Barry Seal's Airplane? And it's co-authored by yourself and Daniel Hopsicker. Explain to us briefly who Daniel Hopsicker is.
Dan is a former TV producer, news guy, who had been producing news segments for NBC. He's been following covert operations in the shadow government. He produced a video on the train deaths in Mena, Arkansas, which you can find out about from my newsletter. It's a good video on the two boys who were murdered on the train tracks down there in connection with CIA drug smuggling. He is now writing a biography on Barry Seal, the infamous legendary drug smuggler from the 80s who was tied to Oliver North, George Bush, and Bill Clinton and the whole crew. And Dan and I have known each other for a while. We run an email list together. CIA drugs email list, and we were just kicking some things around, and we both stumbled across different aspects of the story, and actually, we just both dropped everything simultaneously to track down the story about this airplane.
Well, this is a story that should certainly become an issue in the year 2000 campaign. It is an absolute blockbuster and a breathtaking story. Let's get right down to the substance. And by the way, for members of the listening audience who have not read this article, it is not only exhaustive, but it outlines a truly Byzantine series of connections, and I'm going to do my best to give an audio presentation of that, but I emphatically encourage listeners to go and get the original article, whether from the web or from the newsletter itself, and get this down and fax it to news people. This is something people need to discuss. Now, Barry Seal, the fellow in the title, tell us briefly who he was, bearing in mind that we'll get to his contra role in a few minutes.
Well, Adler Berryman Seal was probably the youngest commercial airline pilot in history. He was flying TWAs when he was like 30 years old. He's a long history of CIA connections. Daniel Hopsicker's research ties him to the John F. Kennedy assassination. But during the Contra era, Barry Seal out of Mena, Arkansas, was flying tons, literally tons and tons. We calculate probably enough to fill 8 railroad boxcars full of cocaine to the United States. He was a guy who would have Vice President George Bush's phone number in the trunk of his car and his personal papers. He knew Oliver North. One of his airplanes, the Fat Lady, he flew a sting that was set up by Oliver North supposedly to show that the Sandinistas were dealing drugs. That's well documented. Barry Seal turns up ubiquitously throughout Iran-Contra records and his links both to then-Governor Bill Clinton in Arkansas, to a whole series of corrupt institutions in the state of Arkansas, but also to the whole Iran-Contra apparatus are very, very well documented. He was a colorful guy, had a flamboyant personality, used to boast, as documented in Terry Reid's book Compromised, about he had proof that the Bush boys, the Bush sons, Jeb and George W., were very heavy into cocaine, including videotaped evidence. And he was caught and turned basically when there was a change in the hierarchical leadership of the Contra support movement in 84, 85, when Bill Casey's earlier operations were replaced by Oliver North. And basically when North came in, Barry Seal knew that he was on his way out, but Seal had had direct contacts, of course, to Vice President Bush. Seal was turned and arrested, and he was basically left hung out to dry, even as powerful as he was. And he was murdered, machine gunned, in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, in the spring of 1986. And his assassins later captured admitted to having connections to Oliver North, although that was one of those things that the press should have picked up on, but they didn't. So Seal was a very, very big player in CIA operations during the 80s.
Parenthetically, wasn't the plane that Eugene Hasenfuss was flying in the plane that he'd used in the alleged Sandinista sting?
That's correct. That was a C-123 called the Fat Lady. piloted by Bill Cooper, and Hasenfuss was shot down in 86 on that plane, which started the Iran-Contra investigation.
Right.
And coincidentally, the last place that plane was serviced before it was shot down was by a noted CIA proprietary, Evergreen Airlines, and at their huge air park in Marana, Arizona. So there's no doubt that Barry Seal and CIA were very much in bed together.
A name known to Bay Area residents as the company, one of whose subsidiaries, Evergreen Helicopter, was doing the Malathion spraying back in the early 1980s. Now, before we get to the main body of your story here, Mike, if you would review for us again the allegations concerning George W. and the cocaine sting. You alluded to it in the discussion so far. Flesh that out for us, and then we'll proceed into your article.
Well, going back to about June of this year, author Terry Reed, who was a pilot connected to Barry Seal, and his book, Compromised, has been a bestseller, was in Los Angeles and made some public statements that during the 2000 presidential campaign, a videotape was likely going to surface, showing that in 1985, after receiving some information, the FBI and DEA set up a sting to videotape two wealthy people coming into Tamiami Airport. That's a private airport outside of Miami, Florida, to pick up a couple kilos of cocaine. Barry Seal provided the cocaine for that sting. But as it turned out, to everyone's surprise and chagrin, the two people turning up to pick up the cocaine were George W. Bush and Jeb Bush, flying in on a Beech King Air 200 turboprop. From Texas. And I have basically been working trying to track down that sting and the location of that videotape for some time now. I've uncovered several sources who confirm that the sting took place. Haven't been able to find the tape. A lot of people are very much afraid for their lives, but I kept looking around for evidence of anything that would tie George W. to this, and this was how we began to look for tail numbers. And one particular tail number, as we were in this, November 6308 Foxtrot, or 08 Foxtrot as we call it, turned out, in fact, to be a Beech King Air 200. And this was a Beech King Air 200, and this number was found in Barry Seal's records by his widow and given to Dan Hopsicker. What was interesting was that as soon as we ran a registry history, a title search on the King Air 200 08 Foxtrot, we found out that it is currently in the fleet of the State of Texas Aircraft Pooling Board, and the governor of Texas, George W. Bush, flies on that plane regularly today.
Now, you mentioned that during the campaign he's apparently going to suspend his use of that aircraft, but it has been one of his personal favorites in terms of his frequent jaunts.
I have an on-the-record quote from the executive director of the State of Texas Aircraft Pooling Board that he flies on that plane all the time, and that while he's a candidate, of course, for political purposes, he does not. But when he's back in the state doing state business, he certainly can and certainly probably will, according to one other source. He'll be on that plane very quickly when it's Texas business, so yes.
A fascinating connection, and you connect the seemingly distant Barry Seal with George W. and his, or the state of Texas' ownership of that plane, with what is truly a Byzantine series of connections through one front after another and a series of machinations that I think would challenge a team of investigators, and that's by way of complimenting you and Daniel Hopsicker for a truly dogged and penetrating piece of work. Let's, in a sense, start at the beginning with the story of the tale of the Contra cocaine. Spring of 1982, the Contra war was swinging into high gear, and you begin with the blowing of the bridges in Managua.
Yes, Dan did a very good history there that as the CIA was gearing up its secret and not-so-secret war against the Contras, it was kind of one of those situations in which all of the covert warriors from the heights of the Cold War, it was kind of like, we're going to have a party, let's go. And all the old guys and the old team and the new team came together, and they started with some very nasty covert operations in Central America. But it was an indicator that the stops were being pulled out at the highest levels of U.S. government to wage war against the Sandinistas.
And the Democrats actually cut off formal aid to the Contras, and this basically entailed, this launched a series of machinations by elements of the military and elements of the CIA to circumvent the Boland Amendment, and that initiated the machinations of Barry Seal. If you would sort of bring Barry Seal's efforts into the story at this point in time with regard to the Contra War.
Okay, well, in the early days of the Contra War, the Contra support efforts were being run by Bill Casey very much, but also very heavily by John Singlaub, a retired Army general, who was a longtime CIA guy who had commanded Special Operations Group in Vietnam, who was very active in Arizona with people later connected to the Keating savings and loan scandals. John Singlaub was involved, Richard Secord was involved, a lot of the old covert players, Ted Shackley, Tom Clines, in the early years. And actually, I know that you know this, there was more than one Boland Amendment. There was Boland 1, Boland 2, and Boland 3, actually,
mm-hmm.
Which changed the screws, if you will, on how Congress was prohibiting action, which the CIA was then getting around. But it became a policy of the government to engage in a whole series of massive financial frauds and escapades involving insurance scams, leasing bust outs, very much similar to what the mafia would do when they would do a bust out of a business they would take over. They would get into Joe's restaurant, who had good credit, and Joe owed him $10,000, and they'd say, okay, we're going to run your restaurant, and the mafia would max all of his credit lines to the tune of $500,000, order all kinds of supplies, ship that out the back door, and then declare bankruptcy and leave Joe on the street. Well, that was very much the way things worked during Iran-Contra, and it was actually the model for the savings and loan scandal of the era.
Something which overlaps this tortuous tale that you weave here.
Yes.
Mike, tell us about Felix Rodriguez and the TTFs, or Tactical Task Forces.
Well, Felix is a legendary guy. He goes back to CIA operations around the Bay of Pigs. He was a policeman in Cuba before Castro came in. He was the guy who, with covert operatives, tracked down Che Guevara in Bolivia and was there when Che was killed and still has Che's wristwatch. He's a legendary, quote-unquote, CIA freedom fighter. Felix ran the Ilopango Airport in El Salvador, where tons and tons and tons of cocaine were being flown back to the U.S. Felix was a covert warrior of the highest order, and he started creating these little brigades that, you know, and schooling people and creating these paramilitary units to go out and blow things up and do assassinations and do combat. And he had all these great plans for that. Of course, that takes money and that takes supplies. But Felix was very much on the operational end of all of that.
You talk about a military intelligence group that was involved in these activities called Yellow Fruit. Tell us about that.
Well, there were actually there was a whole series of operations connected with that, and we have named several of those in the article. And by the way, all of these operations have been verified in terms of their reality by the likes of Judge Lawrence Walsh, who was the Iran-Contra investigator, the Kerry Committee, various Freedom of Information Act documents. These operational names are very much real and very much on the record. And, of course, Yellow Fruit stands for banana, which likens to Banana Republic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember right now. Daniel wrote that part. But Yellow Fruit, as I recall, was one of the funding operations for this, wasn't it?
Yes. Yellow Fruit was a special military intelligence outfit that was headed up by a Colonel Jerry King that was involved with helping to support the Contra effort and also other activities in Central America. And the Army, Secret Army financing through Fort Meade, probably the Army Secret Intelligence Command at Fort Meade, for which, by the way, Linda Tripp worked, in addition to her work for the Delta Force at Fort Bragg, was one of the institutions that you cite as being involved in this particular series of machinations. I would also point out, too, that among the many employers of Barry Seal, as documented in your article, was the DIA. That's something people don't know much about, Mike. You might want to take just a minute and tell listeners about the DIA, because it's something people don't hear about.
Defense Intelligence Agency is, for lack of, just to make it simple, it's the CIA for the Pentagon. which deals or is supposed to deal primarily with gathering military intelligence related specifically to military operations. In other words, what's the maximum tire pressure of a Soviet BMP personnel carrier? That's the kind of stuff DIA is supposed to do. Of course, more complicated than that, and I guess more sexy as well. DIA is, in the U.S., probably the Soviet counterpart was called the GRU, which was, you know, they were to gather strictly intelligence on military matters. But as we know from our history in the U.S., anytime you create a secret intelligence organization, it quickly branches out and starts doing all kinds of things it probably shouldn't be, because it's allowed to operate in secret. Out of DIA, or out of the Pentagon, we also see this highly secret organization called the Intelligence Support Activity, which got very closely connected with not only the Contra work and drug trafficking, but with the POW missions of the 1980s. Bo Greitz got involved. It was founded by Richard Stilwell, and they had some very questionable financial practices, as did all of these. And ISA links directly to the story of this airplane just by virtue of the personnel that were involved.
You cite a Joint Chiefs operation named Elephant Herd as being what, for lack of a better term, might be the jumping-off point for what, again, I want to stress for listeners, is a very complex and Byzantine series of operations. It's not hard to see why something as scandalous as a drug-smuggling plane would wind up in, or could wind up in the hands of the state of Texas and a presidential candidate, when one sees just how complex these operations were. And you mentioned Summit Aviation, one of a number of intelligence-connected outfits, and some work they did with some Cessnas.
Mm-hmm. And basically, there was a need for just a whole bunch of airplanes. You just can't put an army in the field without creating a vast logistical support network. And Elephant Herd was the operational arm of that, to get small private aircraft to be used not only to ferry personnel, just small numbers of personnel, 8-10 at a time, but also quantities of money and small quantities of weapons and small quantities of supplies, but also to get people from point A to point B in secret so that you could have meetings. And the military and CIA and DIA and all the people that were involved in Elephant Herd were laundering Cessna aircraft out through National Guard units. And these Cessna aircrafts were, of course, being loaned and washed and paperwork confused, like which shell is the pea under, and they were turning up ultimately in Central America.
One of the things that's striking is just how many different companies were willing to play ball here. Obviously, some of them just fronts. You point out that one of the many companies here is a company called Flightcraft, and when you contacted Flightcraft, they had some very interesting things to say, or some very interesting things not to say.
When Flightcraft, and now we're on the story of this one particular King Air 200, which
right.
is the one that Barry Seal controlled, and it's the one that that Texas Governor George W. now flies on, which we have also linked to Southern Air Transport. We can save that for like the biggest cherry on top you've ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
But the first owner, it's any aircraft, you can get a title history, and we got the title history on 08 Foxtrot. And the first paper owner was a company called Flightcraft in Oregon. And apparently this plane was already well claimed long before it was delivered new from the factory. And they had apparently gotten wind of what we were doing, because when I called up there, these guys were just, they were stammering nervous. What's your question?
That's all, folks, right?
Yeah, and I asked the guy the question. He said, well, I don't think we want to, we're not going to help you. We're not going to be able to help you. Total nervousness, because what we found in checking the paper trail, now there are several paper trails, one of which is the title history of the airplane, which works very much like a title history for a house. The other is what I went to as a check, and nobody expected I would do this, was to check the Form 337s, which are any time major mechanical repair work is done on an aircraft, they have the mechanics have to file documents with the FAA showing ownership, and those documents did not list the same owners that we had on the title history. So right away we had some serious flaws in the FAA record keeping or in who was reporting what to the federal government about ownership of this airplane. We show one particular owner, Merrill Bean, a car dealer who was a very large car dealer in Utah and California. He was a very rich guy, gets around a lot, now owns jet aircraft. But we show another company on the 337s, United Services, and when I questioned Merrill Bean about that, he said, well, I just formed this insurance company with some other car dealers to underwrite car purchases, you know, financing and insurance and payments and all that stuff, and we shared the plane together. Well, the FAA didn't know that. And then he gave the name of that company as United Insurance, and I checked with the state of Utah, and guess what? There has never been a United Insurance license to do business in the state of Utah. And Merrill Bean's holding company, Prentice Hall, not the school, not the textbook depository, which is spelled P-R-E-N-T-I-C-E, but Merrill Bean's company, Prentice Hall, a Delaware corporation, according to Merrill Bean, doesn't, according to the state of Delaware, exist.
Isn't that special?
Yeah. But we see that stuff going all over the place with this airplane.
And let me stress yet again that this is a Byzantine series of connections. And again, it must have been exhausting just to follow the paper trail alone, let alone trying to pin down some of these operators. Speaking of some operators, a couple of people that you talk about are a couple of individuals named Ken Miller, or Ken Miller Aircraft Sales, and also a fellow named Eugene Glick. If you could tell us about them as briefly as possible.
Well, in the history of the airplane, it was delivered first to Flightcraft, and then it was leased to also through Ken Miller Aircraft Sales, and they are now defunct. Don't know where they are, don't know what happened to them, don't know who they are or anything. It was just another piece of paper in a chain of title. Then we see that the airplane was leased or sold as a new airplane to a company called Graycast, a subsidiary of Greyhound, which in turn leased the airplane to developer-builder Eugene Glick. And Glick turns up, coincidentally, on all kinds of records connected to Barry Seal on a number of airplanes, but also purchasing and leasing powerboats, speedboats, like cigarettes, which were very commonly used for drug smuggling.
In fact, Donald Aronow, the inventor of the cigarette boat and a friend of George Bush's, was machine-gunned shortly after the Iran-Contra scandal broke.
Isn't that amazing?
And there's a book out called Blue Thunder, I think it's by Eugene Burdick, that goes into Mr. Aronow's interesting connections, kind of like a seagoing Barry Seal.
Yes. Well, Gene Glick was doing a lot of financially funny things with Barry about leasing things, but we have a leasing arrangement between Continental Desert Properties, which is, according to the documents that we have, Eugene Glick's development company in 1982, and Baton Rouge Aviation, and Barry Seal was Baton Rouge Aviation, that was his company. But we also have an insurance policy signed for by Barry Seal on 08 Foxtrot, the same airplane. So in the course of a very short period of time, this new airplane has had four or five owners and winds up in the hands of Barry Seal in Louisiana. And it stayed there for an undetermined length of time, we guess 2 to 3 years, until Graycast apparently went under. That was being systematically looted by people with strong CIA connections, we were later to find. And then the airplane was repossessed, and then it was sold to Merrill Bean, but that doesn't end its the airplane's shady history. Because Eugene Glick apparently collected about $2,600,000 on insurance for the defaulted lease. It's a $2 million airplane. So somebody made some money when somebody stopped making payments, and that also is extremely typical of Iran-Contra financial activity.
Yeah, I was going to say, your contributing editor, Catherine Austin Fitz, whom we've discussed before, mentioned that this type of situation could have been deliberately arranged in order to pay off an operator.
Mm-hmm. And that was very, very regularly done. As the savings and loans were looted, insurance policies and bust-outs, as Catherine calls them, or loan brokering, as she calls them, were a routine matter, of course, to have people buy very expensive pieces of equipment, default, and then have the insurance companies reimburse. In the meantime, the equipment that the covert operatives needed is very much out there in the field and being used, as 08 Foxtrot was. So we had Graycast now connected to a group of people that were absolutely looting Greyhound, And I mean to the tune of millions and millions of dollars.
Now, this is Greyhound Leasing, not the Greyhound Bus Company proper, right?
But it was the same family of companies, yes.
But one is a subsidiary of the other, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And so Daniel did an excellent job of documenting how Greyhound was looted. And then we found that Greyhound and Greycast were owned by a company called Finova.
And Finova also owns a company that will be familiar to anybody. By the way, if you wanted to make another point here, I was just going to say that many people are familiar with another company owned by Greyhound Leasing, or Finova, which became relatively well-known during the Iran-Contra affair.
Absolutely.
And its initials are the same as a college entrance exam.
Except for it's not the Scholastic Aptitude Test, it's Southern Air Transport.
Yes, indeed.
Which filed bankruptcy last year, probably as a result of the Gary Webb stories, and in their bankruptcy filing, they show that their parent holding company is Finova, which is the same company which owned Greyhound, which is the same company which owned Greycast, which is the same company that owned 08 Foxtrot.
By the way, of course, Southern Air Transport for Bay Area residents used to fly in and out of Oakland Airport. It came out at the time of the Iran-Contra scandal. So we're dealing with a very complex series of companies here. Greycast or Greyhound Leasing, they are the same, correct?
Correct.
And in turn, they became the entities. It almost sounds like a science fiction movie or a ghost story. They became the entity called Finova. And Finova is also a parent company of Southern Air Transport, a near-legendary CIA air proprietary.
There you go.
There are a lot of interesting names here that crop up in terms of the people who have at one time or another held possession of this plane. We can touch briefly on the person, and we'll carry on the discussion in the next half of the tape. But somebody named Morgan Mitchell of Vail, Oregon, was one of the many people who got involved with this imbroglio.
And he's the only one that we have just absolutely been unable to find anywhere.
In other words, he's at this point still a blank check or a question mark.
Yes, huge. We don't know who or where he is, but it's like there are so many pieces of paper. You can get lost here, but the true way to understand the story is not so much to get lost in the maze of paperwork. It is to grasp that we have absolute proof here, documented evidence, that Barry Seal owned this plane that was connected to CIA, that was, of course, Barry Seal being a huge drug smuggler, and to Iran-Contra operations, which lead directly back to then-Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush. And that same plane is now in the fleet of the Texas State Aircraft Board, which is being flown on by George Bush's son. And we have reports of George W. flying into Tamiami in 85 to pick up 2 kilos of cocaine. I mean, this is far beyond if you think that Watergate was broken by the fact that Howard Hunt's business card was found in Eugenio Martinez's wallet. We are light years ahead of having that much stuff going for us.
Your article might have been subtitled "Signed, Sealed, and Delivered." Mike, we're almost at the end of this side. If you could very quickly give the audience the particulars about your newsletter and website and how they can contact you by email.
From the Wilderness is published monthly. This current story is the 20th consecutive issue. You can read an excerpt of the story on our website, which is at www.copvcia.com, copvcia.com. You can subscribe right there on the web. If you want to write and get information about From the Wilderness, you can write to us at Post Office Box 6061-350 in Sherman Oaks, California, and that's 91413. And for anyone who writes to us at P.O. Box 6061-350 and mentions Dave Emery and subscribes, we will give you 4 free issues just because you're one of Dave's listeners and we happen to like Dave. Or you can call during normal business hours at 818-788-8791.
And your website?
www.copvcia.com.
All righty, and we'll be visiting with Mike Rupert in the next side of this tape, the second half of the interview, in this fascinating tale of the tape, so to speak. For Mike Rupert, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.